Welcome to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. Chief John Douglas, who has worked in the Overland Park Police Department for more than 40 years, is about to step down to become Director of Safety and Security for the Shawnee Mission School District. Chief Douglas has seen Overland Park grow into a major city and one with its fair share of big city issues. He's also credited with a number of innovations, including a program to combat racial profiling in municipal law enforcement agencies. Chief John Douglas joins us now. And Chief, welcome and congratulations on the retirement and on the new gig, too. So good to have you.
Well, thank you very much. It's going to be interesting.
Yeah. Well, you haven't retired yet, Chief, but there are some prominent folks in town already saying that you failed at retirement because you have another job already lined up. What do you want to say to them?
Well, that would be Leo, and he failed.
The chancellor of UMKC. Yeah.
Yes, and he told me that, like himself, I was failing at retirement by picking up another job immediately after. So.
Yeah. Are you ready to go with job number two here?
Getting ready. I mean, there's a transition period, and I think it's as much for me as it is for the department. But the department is positioning for the next police chief, and I'm positioning myself for the next role.
So you are technically the chief for how much longer?
Until the night before I retire on April 17th.
So you still have a couple months left to go.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Who's the new chief going to be?
I don't know. That's up to the city manager, and I'm sure he'll figure that out through a process he's already started.
That process is up and going right now, then?
As far as I understand, they're interviewing consultants, and they'll do some type of national search and go through a process that will allow them to pick the next person.
Do they want a chief to start when you're still around to sort of get the benefit of your experience, or what's the thinking there?
No, I think the process.
I guess you're not really going anywhere, but yeah.
The process will take longer than I have left, but they'll have an interim chief from within the department who may or may not become the chief of police later on. But that interim will be one of my two deputy chiefs, and they're both very capable.
Huh. Well, during your nearly 41 years with the department, Chief, you've worked in every division. You've been a detective, a sergeant, and a member, and a commander of a tactical team. You've been chief. And I guess now the question is, what's the best job on the force?
Well, you know, I really enjoyed being a detective. I was really fortunate early in my career to be a detective, and I worked we were not big enough to specialize into one area or another, but I worked what was called persons crimes, which was rape, robbery, and homicide.
But back in those days, you didn't have any rape, robbery, or homicide in Overland Park, did you?
You'd be surprised.
Really?
We had more homicides then than we do now.
Really?
We did, actually. It was not uncommon to have two, three, or four a year, whereas today we have one or two. And, you know, there's a lot of reasons for that, one of which is changes in the domestic violence law. But I worked on about 13 homicides in a three-year period of time. And you can't say you enjoyed that, but it was an intriguing job, and it was a job that had a lot of meaning to it. You knew it was important.
Is being a detective just like it's sort of portrayed on TV, or is it something very different than that?
Well, you know, I never had any really good-looking female partners. But there's a lot of
listening to this that doesn't need to be listening to this. Yeah.
Outside of that, it's a lot the same. I mean, it's a lot of legwork. It's a lot of science anymore. It's a lot of following up and following through. But the biggest thing is most crimes are solved because of the cooperation of the public and the people who help you with pieces of information. You know, without that, it becomes very, very difficult.
You know, the chief in Kansas City, Missouri, sometimes sits in the chair that you're sitting in right now, Chief, and he talks very openly about the fact that they don't get the cooperation from citizens that they need, at least on the Missouri side. What have you seen when it comes to cooperation from your Overland Park citizens and how that's ebbed and flowed over the years, or has it?
Well, that's a great benefit that we've had, is that for the most part, the citizens and the people who are involved are very active in helping us solve those kinds of crimes. And so I feel for Chief Forte, is that makes his job much more difficult. But we've had a couple of instances where that was not the case. And so we work really hard at trying to keep it flowing and moving along.
What do you do when there's a major crime and folks aren't interested in talking to you about what might have happened? What do you do?
Well, that's a really good question. I'd have to ask Daryl. He's probably more of the expert on that than I am. But, You know, we've had one of those. We had a homicide a year ago, and we've had very difficult time trying to solve it because everybody involved in it has been extremely closed-mouthed. And it's almost like back in the 80s when we were dealing regionally with the mafia killings.
Yes.
You know, they tried to do it and solve it themselves, which only leads to more homicides and more difficulties. So you just have to find a way to get leverage on some of the key players that have knowledge. And, you know, if they don't give it to you freely and openly, you have to find a way to make it in their best interest.
You know, talk about that a little bit. How do you get leverage on someone you need to talk to? How do police do that?
Well, you know, fortunately, those kinds of instances happen in a criminal culture where most everybody involved in it has some kind of criminal activity.
Mm-hmm.
And criminal knowledge. And so consequently, they may not be directly involved in the homicide, but they may be involved in other criminal behaviors that allow us the opportunity to charge them or position them to, require some type of negotiated deal.
You know, it's really interesting looking at the crime stats for Overland Park, you know, going back a number of years. And what really struck me about it, the numbers I looked at went back to 2008, I believe. And almost in every category of crime, Chief, when you got to 2009, things jumped. And, of course, you think back to what was happening in 2009. That was the beginning of the Great Recession. How closely, you know, is the economy tied to crime rates, even in a town like Overland Park?
Well, I think that was a national trend, not just a local or regional trend. And I think what you find is it isn't so much economic that suddenly people are out of work and they're committing crimes. It's the level of anxiousness and angst. It's the level of anger. You know, a lot of things were abuses at home. Children, domestic violence had a change in character there.
Jobs taken away from people and they get frustrated, you're
saying. Extreme frustration and extreme issues concerning their own self-value and how they look at themselves. And you know, people who are self-contained, who have a very good opinion of themselves, who feel like life is worthwhile, are not generally the criminal element. It's those who have low self-esteem, who feel betrayed or feel like their circumstances are society's fault, but feel they're sometimes at war with society.
Yeah, so as a veteran police officer, as a veteran chief, John, do you get to a point in your career where you see the economy teeter and then almost go into free fall? And do you think to yourself, uh-oh, here it comes?
You do. And actually, in a strange way for us at the beginning of a Great Recession, let me give you an idea of something that happened that we decided upon that really is not what you would normally think of. The city of Overland Park was designed in 1960 to be a very progressive, business-responsive community. And as such, much of it is the result of a very robust sales tax. And that's been a very good thing for Overland Park, especially the way it matured over time. Now we're faced with a Great Recession starting in 2008, and we look around and we think, you know, from a criminal element side, we're starting to see a lot of business thefts and identity thefts and, you know, significant stuff. Shoplifting that's not your 16-year-old girl stealing lipstick. Shoplifting that is a occupation that brings in six figures in a year.
Mm-hmm.
So we looked at that and we thought, you know, if we can't, with a recession the way it is, we have a lot of small businesses at Oak Park, and if we can't stay on top of the crime at Oak Park and those teeter, we could lose Oak Park. And if we lose Oak Park as a taxing entity, the city itself would have a significant and severe impact. So we looked at that and decided that was a strategic asset and really went hard at reducing the impact of crime at you know, those small businesses at Oak Park and other places.
And you did that how?
Well, we brought in officers and detectives who actually worked in the facilities, worked with the store security folks. My detective division was very instrumental in designing a plan and a program that would reduce retail crime. And we went at that with a lot of vim and vinegar. And so consequently, we were able to enhance the bottom lines of some of those stores that would otherwise be struggling. And
well, lots of folks are familiar with Oak Park Mall, Chief. What do you do to help those? There's so many little stores in there. What could you possibly do?
Well, you make it so it's a really a really good environment for business and a really bad environment for people committing crimes. And you assume that the crimes that are being committed are significant crimes, not, like I said, just minor shoplifting, because these are not minor shoplifting. I mean, periodically you see on the news they'll take down a house and it's full of all of these different products. Well, that's because they, you know, have taken a very strong and robust attack on some of these retail institutions. And so we make it very difficult for them.
And you do that by what? Putting officers in plain sight? I'm just trying to think of the different things.
Officers are in plain sight, but we have detectives. Detective Byron Pierce is one of the best in the country in terms of identity theft. And he has a national reputation. He is very, very strong in that area and has saved well, I'll tell you one case that he had involved airlines where they were taking IDs and credit cards from thefts at Oak Park Mall. And they were turning around and they were buying fraudulently airline tickets. And then they were discounting those airline tickets and selling them and leaving the airlines Wow. to deal with the fraudulentness. The case was so big that when we solved it and improved one particular airline's bottom line nationally for a quarter.
Wow. Wow.
So you don't think of it that way. You don't realize that we have people who come from all over the country to carry out organized criminal activity in our retail stores. We've had some from as far away as Israel and Russia.
And this notion that people are going to some of those stores in the Oak Park Mall and stealing so much, they're actually making a living off of it. I mean, whenever I think of shoplifting, I think of somebody walking out with a pack of gum, you know?
We have individuals that have stolen so much and you know, they steal iPad boxes and they bring them back with rocks inside and turn them back in for money. And they do all kinds of these kinds of efforts and games, a lot of video games. And then they sell them on eBay. But the scope of these things is so significant that some of these individuals make clearly well over $100,000, $150,000 a year.
That's amazing to me.
And there's a lot of them.
That's just amazing. You look at the crime stats again, sort of staying with that for a moment, and as you head out the door, you know, it's 2014 now, and the numbers across the board for Overland Park all down, at least year over year from previous years. Very significantly and very consistently, it looks like, as you go through all those categories. You got to feel good about that.
Well, I do. But you also have to understand that, you know, that fluctuates too. I think people put too much weight on how much influence the police department actually has on crime. I don't want to take too much credit when it looks really good, because it's not as much our fault when it doesn't look so very good. So We're very responsive to that. Now, having said that, I'm very blessed. We have a very talented and very effective police department.
You know, and one other way of measuring this, there's one other measuring stick that lumps in Overland Park with lots of your peer cities across the country. There's 20, 25 of them in the chart that I was looking at. I didn't count them up. But even in that category, again, you look right across the board in the different crimes, Overland Park very much in the bottom third, maybe even sometimes the bottom 20%. Again, how do you feel about that?
Well, I feel great. Are you referring to the benchmark cities?
Yeah, there you go.
That's an interesting story, how we got the benchmark cities. And at the end of it, it'll kind of explain why I think we're all better because of it.
Olathe is one of them.
Uh-huh. Just,
yeah.
Olathe
and cities across the country as well, yeah.
When I first became the chief of police, I should have been praying, I suppose, at Mass one morning. But I'm thinking to myself, you know, we have a good reputation, but how good really is it, and what can I do to make it any better? And so I created a survey to send out to 25 cities. And I went down to the Chamber of Commerce to find out who I should send it to, cities like ourselves. And, you know, they were the cities that we compete with for business, the Richardson, Texas, and the Bellevue, Washingtons. And they were cities like us. They were edge cities, AAA rated cities. They had the means and the capability to do these things. And I sent a survey out. And I got all this information back, and it looked really good. And then I got a lot of questions like, why does Garland, Texas, so low in traffic accidents? Why is Fremont, California this way or that way? So I invited the chiefs to come for a small summit just to talk about that. And I was surprised, but they all came, and they all came, and we sat down, and we talked about that. And from that point on, we've had the Benchmark Cities Survey and Summit.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you're going to find in that list, when you see all the top 25 everythings, you're going to see most of the cities in that benchmark group because we exchange information, not just annually, but virtually daily. Things are flying back and forth, and it's made every one of those cities better. So this was an accidental thing that took place, but something that's turned out to be really positive, and now they're looking to take it nationally for all departments.
So this notion that you know what's going on in a little town in Texas or the state of Washington, that helps you out here in Overland Park. How, Chief?
Well, the very first time we met, we asked Garland how they were so effective cutting down intersection violations, because it's really hard to get a stoplight violation because you're on the wrong side of the light. You're either behind the car when you can see it turn, or you have to rush through the red light to catch the person doing it. Well, Garland figured it out. They mounted a light on the top of the signal so that when it changed, they could be across the street, and they didn't need four cars to do it. And we're all slapping our head with that aha moment, thinking it's little things like this that others are doing. And we're not in competition. We're not Ford and GM. Stealing each other's ideas was a great thing.
We're visiting with John Douglas, who's been chief of police of Overland Park since 1996. He's been an officer there since 1973. He's retiring in a couple of months to become director of safety and security for the Shawnee Mission School District. If you have a question for the chief about Overland Park, policing in general, our number here, 816-235-2888. Again, 816-235-2888. Or you can email us to update@kcur.org. or tweet us @KCUR up to date. You know, Chief, no question the Overland Park of 2014 sure isn't the Overland Park of 1973.
No, it sure isn't. I started February 16th, 1973. I'll cross 41 years next week.
You remember the date still?
Oh, I remember it. It was snowing. I remember everything about it. And at that point in time, Neiman became a dirt road after 95th Street. And the alternate, the
Remember
things
that?
We call the alternate, was under construction. And Oak Park Mall was, a year old. And Metcalf South was a booming metropolitan shopping area. I remember the city expanding to the south and how it kind of stopped in place at 435. And then once it jumped 435, how massive that change was.
Yeah.
Now, there's been a lot of changes, and it's been a very, very interesting and intriguing 40 years.
I mean, you get a sense that today, the Overland Park, Kansas of today, is much more of a town, of a city that has some of the same issues that lots of other cities have. You have higher poverty now, more poor folks living in Overland Park, those kinds of issues, some big city crime kinds of issues in Overland Park. Again, a big change from when you began.
Well, we've gone through the change of being a suburban bedroom community to a metropolitan, urbanized city.
Mm-hmm.
Now, different areas are going through urbanization faster or more than others. But, you know, we're moving in that direction. But I think people forget, because we're a part of a Kansas City metropolitan area, how big we are. And to put it in perspective, we're about almost 180,000 people, with a daytime population that, depending upon who you listen to, ranges between 300 to 350,000 people.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Salt Lake City is about 185 to 190,000 people with a daytime population of about 350,000.
No kidding.
So
very
you can
similar.
See right off the bat, but while we still have some suburban characteristics, we're a major metropolitan city all to our own, and would be with or without Kansas City.
And Chief, when you have a change, an evolution in a city like Overland Park over the years, what one or two areas of crime have become more prominent and remain the ones that you worry about so much today?
Well, crime changes. I mean, at a point in time early in my career, we were having almost twice as many burglaries as we have today. There's a lot of reasons why we have fewer ones, but technology is one of the biggest reasons, because you can steal more money with a computer sitting in an apartment in Moscow than you can robbing a bank.
People aren't better. They're just better ways of stealing it.
It's always a battle. It's always a checkerboard of who plays the next card and how the next person gets to it or around it. So, you know, that's a lot of it is how things have changed. I asked the city council about 8 years ago for a unit that would help us do cyber crimes. And I told them then it was the new frontier because you could get anything there, but you can't anywhere else. But there's no law enforcement there, just much like it was Dodge City 150 years ago.
Yeah.
And so that's borne out to be true. And we have very strong initiatives in the cyber arena right now.
How many people do you have in that department?
I think we've got like three out of a crime analysis unit that work in that area, plus two more in – well, we've got three total because there's two more in the cyber crimes or crimes against children.
I mean, are they working cyber crimes in terms of things that are occurring in Overland Park, Chief, or can you localize a cyber crime?
Nope.
Yeah.
You get into the cyber arena, you're all over the place.
I was going to say.
And we work cases that have gone a couple cases that have gone national and some that have gone international because the cyber environment doesn't recognize political boundaries.
How difficult does that make it for you to sort of justify that expense then to your city council when maybe you're prosecuting bad guys in Russia when they want you to be going after bad guys in Overland Park?
Well, I think it's together. I mean, we had a case that was involving Europe that I believe the person who was selling peer-to-peer child pornography lived in Overland Park and they had discovered it in, I think, Germany. So you can understand how that goes both directions. And, you know, a person who takes tries to contact young girls on the internet, they may live in Topeka, they may live in Wichita, they may live in some other place, but it's our girls that are being exploited. So you can't really draw a line around that. And I think that what you do to solve crime in Overland Park is like what you do to solve cancer. It may not be so much about locality as it is totality.
So what's the single crime you worry about most today? What preoccupies your time the most in Overland Park, Kansas right now, Chief?
Well, the thing predominantly I've concentrated on has not been so much a crime, but a change in structure and a change in part of our community. We've got the area to the northwest, the area bounded between 63rd Street and 95th Street, Antioch West. It's some of the oldest parts of Overland Park, and it is changing in character. It's changing because the housing stock has changed. It's changing because
it's deteriorated.
Some of it is. Mm-hmm. And, you know, a lot of people keep their neighborhoods very, very good shape, some not as much. And that has an issue. But the biggest thing is much of that housing was just post-World War II. And it was built at standards that would be different than today. I mean, very few houses sold today are two-bedroom and one bath or even three-bedroom and one bath without a basement and other things. So the value of that housing, to a degree, has slipped. And when that happens, changes take place. But
not good changes, I gather, in some cases.
Well, you have to evaluate the change. Now, let me be specific about this. Those neighborhoods, many of them, have changed the quality of the wealth that's in the neighborhoods. You can take a look at the Shawnee Mission School District, and you can take a look, for example, at the assisted lunches. We have some schools that have 80% assisted lunches. Now, that's typical of an urban area more than a suburban area. And that's nothing wrong with that. It's not like these people are bad or they're criminals, but it does mean that they have vulnerabilities. And being poor or lack of wealth is a vulnerability. And the problem with vulnerabilities is that the predators find the vulnerable. And, you know, it's the people who are vulnerable that need our help the most, people who are substantial and have wealth and can afford alarm systems and other devices, they need our help as well. But people who can't take care of themselves quite as well oftentimes are the ones that need the help. The single moms trying to raise two or three kids. And all of these things put together are factors that we look at, understanding that it creates a circle of issues.
So you're watching those neighborhoods closely, it sounds like.
We are watching them very closely. We have five specific goals in those areas to include the elimination and reduction of gang activity, the elimination and reduction of narcotic sales, prostitution, removing career criminals from living there, because all of these things create issues for the vulnerable. And what you have is, once you have a neighborhood that moves in that direction and starts thinking it's okay that, you know, down in the neighborhoods to the south, it's not okay that the guy next door is on probation for robbery.
Yeah.
They would be all over that. It's not okay that you know somebody that is selling drugs on the corner. It's not okay that two-thirds of the people you know are gang members. And so up in other areas, it should not be okay there either. And those things are the things we have to go after, so that they don't think that that's just the way it is.
I'm going to get some phone calls for Chief John Douglas, the retiring police chief of Overland Park, in just a moment at 816-235-2888. Chief, I just asked you what part of your town, what crime you're worried about now. What's the crime? You talked about cybercrime as something coming a number of years ago. You spotted that trend. What's the crime that you see down the road that you're watching now that might be more prevalent 5, 10, 15 years down the road?
I'm concerned about the effects of violence in public areas. Certainly with my new job, I'm going to be very worried about the schools. Not that I haven't already. We've done some pretty good things to date. But there seems to be the copycat individual who wants to walk into the movie theater or wants to walk into the shopping mall or certainly the schools and suddenly take out all of their anger and hostility and feelings about themselves on everybody else. I mean, it's a scary thing when a person walks into a school like Newtown, Connecticut, and shoots little babies.
Well, it seems like it's almost a trendy crime right now. It's just happened so much the last few years.
Well, remember many, many, many years ago on the Twilight Zone, Rod Sterling had a show about the forcible taking of an aircraft. Until that show aired, I don't think there was ever an airliner that had been hijacked.
No kidding.
And after that, hijackings went way up. And so there is a...
So when Columbine happens and there's a template out there, then people begin to latch onto it.
Yes. And ironically, Columbine was not the first school violence issue. That was clear back in the late 1700s. But once it received that kind of notoriety and it went national, it's much like the political assassin. It's the 30 seconds of fame that makes a person's name last forever.
Yeah.
And to people who have very low self-esteem and are acting out in that way, it's a phenomenon that's very unfortunate.
Let's go to some phone calls here again for Chief John Douglas. Let's go to Mike from Overland Park. Mike, you're on the air with your chief. Good morning.
Good morning, Steve. Chief, thank you for 40 years of service to the citizens of Overland Park and helping to make that police department a best-in-class police department nationally. A couple of quick questions. One, there was an article in the Kansas City Star earlier this week about federal funding going away in terms of grants and other monies that have been out there and have helped departments like Overland Park have equipment and training that perhaps would have been much more difficult had those funds not been out there. I'd like you to comment on, as those go up, how you see that playing out for Overland Park. And then second of all, in that same vein, how do you see the budget and the staffing for Overland Park police resources going forward, and how do you see the city as having to invest to keep our police department best in class going forward? Thanks, Chief. I'll take your answers off the air.
Yeah, good questions, Mike. Let's begin with the federal money, the story in the Star this week that talked about federal money, as we all know, in so many cases, going away in so many categories.
Well, a lot of what we're talking about is what we call the UASI money, the Urban Initiative money. And that was 25 to 30, depending on what year, large cities that received a lot of anti-terrorism funds, and we were able to buy some equipment and do some training that were really aimed at combating terrorism. But, you know, over my 41 years, federal funds have ebbed and flowed. You know, when I actually came into the business because of the major initiatives after the 68 Democratic Convention in Chicago, and they wanted to revolutionize and change police work and were looking for college-educated folks.
Hmm.
So that was the first big initiative that I know of. And ever since then, there have been other initiatives that come and go. And our government tends to be on a carousel of crisis next? And so that's where they put my money, is the next big crisis. So I think that comes and goes, and we've been the beneficiary of a lot of funds which have moved us forward, but it's probably time for other initiatives. Now, as far as the local budgets, you know what? There's only so much money in the pie, and you can't put it all in one place or another place. But I will tell you conscientiously that our government and our council has been very, very in tune to the needs of a police department and trying to make public safety a major issue.
How many members of the force do you have? How big is your department, total personnel?
We have a – well, total personnel is about 340 or so. The number of officers we have is 250, so you have to have civilian support staff. We need more, but we also need more park time. We also need better streets. We also need a lot of things, and we're a very – very established, in many ways, a very good city. So it's a constant balance of moving things around.
Well, Chief, you have 250. If you could wave a magic wand and get the number that you think is the optimum right number to have for Overland Park, what would that number be?
You know, it's hard to say. I mean, if money was not an issue and there was no other priorities, I'd certainly like to see in the next 10 years another 50 officers.
Mm-hmm.
But that's also, you know, that's just a guess in the wind. That's just if I needed them or if I wanted them, here's how many it'd be.
An officer costs you what? I mean, just total cost of hiring an officer for your force is what? $100,000 bucks, $120,000 bucks?
About that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You throw in benefits and everything else. Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. And so consequently, it's not that easy. It's just saying how many would you like to have is like asking my wife how many horses she'd like to have. There's always a case to be made.
How many does she want?
Oh, she has 7, so that's enough, don't you think? But the point being is we do have needs in that northwest section. We do have needs to, you know, all over the city. And the next chief of police will continue, I'm certain, to evaluate where we're at, work with the city manager and the council. But I go back to one thing that Don Pipes, the former city manager, told me many years ago. He said, you can always count on the council to do the right thing. They may have to mull it over for a while. They may have to chew on it a bit. But you can always count they'll do the right thing. In my opinion, not trying to sound too Homerish, but I always believe that in that city, in all that matters, they'll do the right thing.
But it's always a tug of war, isn't it?
Well, it's competing interests. You've got a lot of people with a lot of needs.
Yeah. Alex from Mission. Alex, you're on with Chief John Douglas. Good morning.
Hi. I just want to thank Chief Douglas for his leadership in the department over these last years. He's, I think, been exemplary. I'm a contractor that employs quite a few people, and we moved throughout whatever the 40-some municipalities, and we found that Overland Park police officers are the most professional as well as personable, and I think that's a reflection of his leadership, and we're going to miss him. I hope his replacement does as good a job as he does, and I wanted to thank him.
Alex, great phone call. Appreciate it.
Well, yeah. I'd like to say thank you to you, Alex, but I got to be honest with you. My influence is pretty small. We just have really, really good people, and I think the credit goes to them.
Yeah, I'm not sure I buy that, but we'll let that statement stand as it is, Chief. But recently on your blog, you recounted the traffic stop 29 years ago that ended with the fatal injury of Officer Deanna Rose, and obviously the homestead named after her today out south there. How did her death affect your department, and how well did you know her?
Well, I actually knew her fairly well. We had worked together on several different things. I'd been a detective sergeant when she first started. She did some work with us upstairs on different things, and I'd become the watch commander shortly before her death. So I was the day watch commander, and she was working midnights, and she got off in the morning, would stop by my office and say hi. She was a delightful young woman. She was perky. She was happy. She was all of these things. And so you might imagine that the loss of any officer, and especially one who's as popular as she was a devastating blow to the department.
She died how, Chief?
She had made a DUI arrest on I-35 right there by what was the old gym store. I'm not sure what it exactly is at this moment. But actually, the roadway has been taken down and shaved off. But she made a stop on this individual who was intoxicated, and at the back of a car, she got into a fight with him, and it was a pretty good fight over trying to be arrested. And he ran back to the car door, opened it up, and she leaned in through the car window to pull the keys out And when she did, he drove away, and that pulled her underneath the rear wheel. And we had just received bulletproof vests, and ironically, the bulletproof vest protected her chest from the weight of a car because it distributed over the deal. But unfortunately, he also ran over her head, and the head injuries were fatal.
If I understand from your blog, right, you went out on the night of the anniversary of that death, and you described the scene on your blog. Why did you go out there?
Actually, I didn't.
You
but
didn't.
Two
okay.
officers did.
Did. Okay, and they described it.
They did. Officer Coos and Officer Andy Black. And police departments are like the military. Tradition and history and those things are very important. And I think they made a connection. I don't know that either one of them knew her. I think they did not. But I think they made a connection over that period of time and felt that out of respect for her, they would go there and kind of make that connection over time.
You know, there's also somebody you think about every Thanksgiving. I think her name was Amy Cobb. Tell us about Amy Cobb and the little girl and her story.
Well, I've often said that in our line of work and, of course, many others, things happen that kind of leave a scar or stain on your soul. And this particular incident was right before Thanksgiving in about 1979, and I was a detective. We were getting ready to go out of town. We had a little boy that was the same age who's now a man and has his own children. But we were getting ready to go to Phillipsburg, Kansas, to my in-laws for Thanksgiving. And I got the call in my office of a death of a child at about 2:30 in the afternoon. And I went to the emergency room, and there was Amy Cobb. She was 2.5 years old, little blonde-haired, blue-eyed baby, and she had reportedly died from drowning in the bathtub. And when I got there, all of these big, tough police officers were standing around in the emergency room and all weepy-eyed. And I looked at that, and I thought, this doesn't make any sense. My own son jumps in and out of a bathtub like a tadpole. Why would this happen? And I saw that she had significant bruising on her abdomen that was different stages of bruising. So I'm thinking, this isn't right. And so what had actually happened was, in the middle of a rain, in the middle of a snow, the individual charged with watching her, who was the mother's boyfriend while she worked, we were moving from Lawrence to here, had knocked her down because she was in the way. And when she fell down, she hit her head. And she was crying, which made him angry. So he picked her up, and then he shoved her again, and she hit her head a second time, and then a third time, and she died of those injuries. So of all of that, we were able to work the case, prosecute it, go forward. But every single Thanksgiving from then on, I stop and wonder about what she would be and who she would be and what her life would have been like. It was a sincere tragedy, but just— You know, those are kind of stories that stick with people in our business.
Let me say they stick with you, and they how do they affect the way you do your job and your commitment to what you do when you come across the stories of Amy Cobb out there?
Well, you start off by not wanting any more Amy Cobbs. And I think that pertains to a lot of the different things we do. But I think it's a tribute to the officers in general that they live through these things, and every one of them, I can tell you, I do not know one of them that would not have numerous stories like this. They manage to go every day, and they continue to go. Like the Energizer Bunny, they put on their equipment, they march out into the snow, they do those things every single night so the rest of us can sleep.
Yeah.
And I think that's a tribute to the character that they are.
Well, Chief, so nice to visit with you. Good luck with your new position in Shawnee Mission, and maybe you can come back sometime and talk with us a little more about that. And we sure appreciate your service.
Well, thank you.
That's retiring Overland Park Police Chief John Douglas. He's been with the force since 1973. He's retiring in just a couple of months to become Director of Safety and Security for the Shawnee Mission School District.